from confusion to conquest. And this message comes out of the book of Habakkuk. You don't hear very much about some of the prophets. I preach about them a lot and talk a lot about them because, well, they're so rich in the material, the meaning, the message of these prophets. You don't hear very much about the minor prophets. And Habakkuk is one of those, not minor in the sense that he's unimportant or insignificant, but the major prophets, their books like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, it's just that the books that they wrote are so much larger. 60 chapters, 50 plus chapters, and Habakkuk just has 3 chapters, 56 verses. And so the minor prophets are called minor mainly because of the size of the writings, not that they're insignificant. And Habakkuk is one of those great stories in the Bible that is so powerful in teaching us about how to deal with the inexplicable dilemmas of life. And when you look at this, you have to understand, first of all, that very little is known about Habakkuk in terms of his identity. Chapter 3 ends with a psalm. It is a psalm. Chapter 3 is a psalm. And it ends with a musical notation, and that causes some to believe that he may have been a Levite. The name Habakkuk literally means to embrace or to wrestle, which is appropriate because, like Jacob, the wrestler in the Old Testament, let me back up on this a bit. In the Old Testament, he wrestles mightily with God. That's what we're going to read about here in just a moment. With Jacob, the struggle took place at a little creek, a tributary of the Jordan River called Jabbok. With Habakkuk, the struggle took place in a watchtower. And the book is very unique. This is important to understand. It's not a sermon. It does not record a message from God to the people. Most of the prophets, their writings contain oracles of God to the people. Here's a message that the prophet is delivering from God to the people. That's not the case with Habakkuk. Habakkuk is a glimpse of the inner life and the inner struggles of the prophet. And written here is a dialogue between God and Habakkuk, between the prophet and his God. And we're allowed the privilege of sort of eavesdropping on their conversation. We get to listen in while Habakkuk talks to God, and then hear when God talks back to Habakkuk. 3 chapters, 56 verses, and they trace the spiritual progress of the prophet and show his emergence from a period of deep confusion and depression to a climactic peak of joy and victory. And there are 4 things that are evident about Habakkuk. And the first of these is that he was a man with problems. Can anybody identify with that? Amen. Here's what you have to understand. Habakkuk lived 600 years before Christ. He lived during turbulent and uncertain times in Judah. The times were marked by spiritual delinquency, injustice, oppression, violence, and wickedness. There were times of political instability, national crisis, and corrupt leadership. And in addition to the moral, spiritual, and political bankruptcy, the threat of war became increasingly inevitable as the war machines of Babylon ground nation after nation into the dust. And it is against this backdrop of distressing conditions that the book of Habakkuk was written, and the personal struggles of this great man emerged. Now here's an important statement. The difficulties around him created a firestorm of problems within him. Can I say that again? The situations and difficulties around him created a firestorm of emotional and spiritual problems within him. That often happens. And he became overwhelmed by them. He developed a spirit of pessimism and even fatalism. His pessimism became more intense, lapsing into doubt and confusion and even accusations, as you'll see in a minute. He was caught in a giant web of frustration. And Habakkuk's greatest struggle, and this is often true with us, in fact, it is most always true with us, the greatest struggle were not the conditions around him, but rather with the confusion that was in him. The confusion that was in him. He was a man with a problem. In fact, he had two problems. The first of these is found here in Habakkuk chapter 1. As he issues this complaint to God. How long, Lord, must I call for help that you do not listen? Stop right there and let me ask you, have you ever thought that or uttered that yourself? Do you see your hand? Come on, can I get a witness? Okay, you're not alone. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly okay. How long must I call for help, but you do not listen? Can I pause and ask you, is he listening? If you told a dirty joke, would he listen? Would he hear it? If you gossiped, would he hear it? If you were lying, would he hear it? When you pray, does he hear it? He does. He does. Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. This is his complaint. And basically, Habakkuk is telling God, you're not doing a very good job. That's what he's saying. I mean, Lord, look at the sin, the idolatry, the contention, the wickedness around us. There is no justice in the land. The wicked prevail over the righteous, and you're not doing anything about it. How can you let this go on? I don't understand why you let this happen. Judah's filled with violence and lawlessness, and you're just sitting on your hands, doing nothing. Why do you look on in silence? Now, those are pretty strong words. And he's pouring them out to God. And I want you to keep this in mind. These are raw emotions there's nothing edited here. There's no sugar coating. There's no religious cliches. He's just pouring out his complaint before God. And rather to be censored or condemned for this, there's something positive about this that I'll tell you about in just a minute. Okay, but just hang on to that thought. God answers him in verse 5 through 11. I didn't put the whole thing up here, but here's what God says. I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are feared, they are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities by building earthen ramps. They capture them. And basically, God says, listen, I'm going to punish Israel. They're going to have to answer for their sin and the injustice and the wickedness. And I'm raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. They're a wicked nation. They're dreadful. They're terrible. They're fierce. They're impetuous. They march through the land making conquest after conquest. They collect captives like the grains of sand on the sea. They mock kings and they laugh. They laugh at fortresses, walled cities they laugh at because they know how to conquer them. They sweep through the land like a wind. They will come upon Israel like a horde. They will be taken into captivity because of their sin, because of their evil. They will be devastated. And God is saying, Habakkuk, I haven't ignored their sin. Their judgment has been delayed, but it's coming, and their perverseness does not go unnoticed. The wicked will be punished, and righteousness will be vindicated. And if you think that this settles the issue, if you think this makes Habakkuk feel better, you're mistaken. It doesn't help him at all. In fact, it makes the matters worse. He's even more disturbed. He began with one problem, now he has two. And he responds, Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment? You, my rock, have ordained them. Who's the them? The Babylonians? The pagan, wicked, evil, idolatrous Babylonians? You've chosen them? Your eyes are too pure to look upon evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. God, this is totally against your nature, he's saying. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You hear the complaint? God, how can you do this? How could you do such a thing? How can a righteous, holy, eternal God who lives forever, how can you use these barbarians to execute judgment upon a people who are more righteous than they? I mean, I know Israel is bad, but the most wicked among the Jews are better than the best among the Chaldeans. God, how can you do such a thing? I mean, Israel's sin is bad, but the Chaldeans are worse. God, you're going to use them to punish us. It would almost be like a modern-day Jew wondering if God was on Hitler's side during the Holocaust. As you look at this, you see, I'll tell you what's happened. He can't fit this into his theology. And theology is a wonderful and a good thing until it collides with reality. And sometimes there's a head-on collision between, and there's this dynamic, and then there's this tension, and I can't resolve this, and I don't quite understand this, and that's where the why questions arise, and why, and where was God, and why did he let this happen, and why? And all of a sudden, this is what he's wrestling with. He's wrestling with here. And he understands that God's integrity is not in doubt here. It's his own confusion that is causing him. Why? I don't understand this. And I know, God, that you are holy and righteous in all of your ways and perfect in all of your ways. So it's not, the problem is not with you, but I can't figure this out. I can't work this out. I can't make this fit into my theology. Has anybody ever been there? No, believe me. I've lived there many, many times. And what you see here as a nation on a larger scale, we certainly are living in turbulent and troubled times. I've got to the point where I almost don't want to watch the news anymore because it's just so depressing at times. And it can make you so angry at times and so frustrated at times. And I don't want to go on a political rant. You know as well as I do what's going on right now. You are well acquainted with the spiritual decline, the moral bankruptcy, the political uncertainties, and now the shadow of political corruption and the overwhelming number of social problems that plague our land. And that's at the broader scale, and we live in that context. But down at a personal level, maybe some of you today are living with some situation, the specifics I don't know about. But it's that kind of situation that just is confused and perplexed, and you can't figure a way out, and you can't see a door to walk through, and you can't, it seems unending. It's interminable. It just never ends. The trial just goes on, and you cry, oh God, how long do I pray to you? And you don't answer. You're not listening. And why are you letting this happen? Why is this going on and on and on? And you find yourself in this same dilemma of somehow trying to bring some kind of resolution to all of this. And while I recognize the legitimacy and the reality of that and what's going on in the larger scale around us, I can tell you that as bad as all of that is, very often the real problem for us and for many people is not out here, but it is in here. Our greater struggle is not with the external problems around us, but with the internal confusion within us. And there are times when we just don't understand what's going on. And we can't get an answer to it. And you just... And sometimes we're like a backup. And we wonder if God even notices the dilemma we're in. And we can't understand why it's taking so long. And why aren't these prayers being answered? And I'm in a dreadful situation. And God, you're not doing too good of a job. You're just not doing anything about it. And the result is lingering doubts and nagging questions that over time can sort of ferment, if you will, into a kind of pessimism and a skepticism and a raging cynicism. And if you're not careful, that attitude can evolve into bitterness and anger, not just against others, but even against God. And when those attitudes take root and produce fruit, they have the tendency to alienate us from the Lord and cut us off from our only source of help. And I'll say this here, the greatest battle we fight is the war within. Here's where life is won or lost in here. Heard me say it 1,000 times. You can't help the things that happen around you. Many times, you can always help how you respond to them. And that's what this is about. I'm trying to help you learn from what Habakkuk did, how to respond to it. The wars of life, the battles of life are won here, not out here. You win in here, you can win out there. You lose in here, you will lose out there. And Habakkuk is just the man to teach us this. We see him in chapter 1 as a man with problems. But before this book is over, there is a complete transformation in Habakkuk, and he doesn't stay in chapter 1. It's okay to be there. Everybody will be there at some point in their life. But he moves forward and emerges from his dilemma with victory, and he moves from confusion to conquest. And some of you right now, you may be in chapter 1, problems on the outside, confusion and hurt on the inside. That's okay. We all go through that. We've all been there, and we probably will be there again. But the issue isn't where you are. The issue is where you're going, and your problem is not your problem. It's how you deal with it or fail to deal with it. How do you go from confusion to conquest? Let's learn it from Habakkuk, and here's the first lesson. Habakkuk was a man of prayer, and I can tell already somebody's saying, I don't want to pray anymore. I've already prayed about this. I've been there. Believe me, I have been there. At one point, I said to God, I should have just wrote this down. I should have just written this prayer down and hung it on the wall. And I could have gone in and said, there it is, God, you read it. Over and over. And I came at it from every angle, and it was at a place where, I know, and you're tired of the groaning, and you're tired of the praying. But let's learn something about this from him. That Habakkuk was a man of prayer. When troubles come like this, are you more likely to go to the phone or to the throne? You see, life's problems will do one of three things to us. They'll either cause us to break, that is to cave in and capitulate to fear and give up, or they'll cause us to lash out with hostility and rebellion, or they will cause us to break through to find solutions and renewed faith. And Habakkuk chose the latter, and it's always a choice. It's always a choice. How you respond is your choice. And if it's a bad choice, the good news is you can change it. Here's how he responded. Here's what he said to all of this. He can't figure it out. Life and theology right now don't make any sense. They are in conspiracy against each other. And here's what he says. I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. The watch. It's a reference to the sentries. They didn't have radar. They didn't have electronic surveillance. So to keep the city, on the walls of the city, they had towers. And in the towers, they had sentries or watchmen who stood and scanned the horizon and watched for the approach of the enemy. And that's the imagery. I will take my stand in a watchtower, and I will wait there, and I will look to see what he will say to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. What will my answer be to this complaint? As a watchman looks from his tower, the prophet will go and watch for an answer from heaven. He is grappling, he is struggling, he is wrestling with this situation. His faith is baffled by his experience. His faith is baffled by his experience. And in utter frankness, he directs his questions to God, not against him. And understand the nature of this questioning. This is why I say there's something positive here in this. His questions do not arise from a rebellious heart to bring railing accusation against God. They arise not out of rebellion, but out of his zeal for God. They reflect his own character and a purity that's in him, because a man who is indifferent and morally lax doesn't ask the kind of questions that Habakkuk asked. They don't care that the weak are being exploited. They don't care that sin is running rampant. They don't care. Do you understand that? It's a statement of his character. He rises in complaint and it reveals his heart. And can I tell you that this is absolutely the truth? The more committed you are, the more passionate you are about God and His kingdom, and the deeper you go with the Lord, the more susceptible you are to the same kind of inner struggle that Habakkuk had. People are just content to draw their breath and their salary. Never ask the kind of deep questions that are perplexing you and maybe tormenting you today. He isn't a man of distinction because of what he says. He's rather a man of distinction because of the direction that he faces, the way he is looking. He teaches us the right response for times of trouble and confusion. The psalmist said it this way, "Be still and know that I'm God." Literally, stop striving. Just be still. Just quit. Quit all this. Be still. Be still. The response is to set a watch, climb the tower, to hear what God will say. Now, I want to tell you, I want to caution you. You can be in that watchtower a long time before you get an answer. Now, I know you want it. You want your answer microwaved. It may be in a crock pot. You get everything else. You get tweets from Twitter and messages from Facebook and email instantly. God's not into our social networking. Doesn't work that way. You can be there for a very long time. And the question is, do you have the patience to wait for an answer? I mean, you may have to really wait. I read in Jeremiah where the wicked leaders of Israel come to Jeremiah and ask him, "Inquire of the Lord of us about a certain thing, and whatever God says, we'll do it." And Jeremiah went to the Lord and inquired of him. And here's what they've asked, "Lord, what is your answer?" And the Bible said that God spoke to Jeremiah 10 days later. I thought, 10 days? He is a prophet of God, from the womb ordained to be a prophet. He hears from God every day. He asked this question, and he had to wait 10 days to get an answer. And I thought, Lord, I can't wait 10 minutes. I want it right now. You remember I told you about the pastor who was pacing back and forth, and the secretary saw him. "Is something wrong?" He said, "Yeah, is something wrong? It's real simple. I'm in a hurry. God is not. It's real simple. And you can't rush him. You cannot rush him. And you have to, all you can do is give him space and wait. And here's something you need to know about hearing the voice of God. If God isn't speaking, you can't hear him. So don't be a ventriloquist and throw his voice. Wait. You wait. And God gives him an answer. He doesn't just complain, he prays. He doesn't just question, he intercedes and he waits. And God answers it. And he says, "The Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it." That's how they got communication spread abroad. Somebody had to take a message and run with it. "For the revelation of the vision awaits an appointed time. So does your answer. So does your breakthrough. There is an appointed time." And he says it to him, and maybe to you, "It will speak at the end. It will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay." The key word is wait, and it's the one word we don't like. We want to make a quick trip down the aisle on Sunday prayer, a quick 3-minute prayer, somebody lay hands on us and fix everything in 5 minutes. Now, occasionally there may be some kind of a miraculous thing that God does in that moment. Who knows, though? That one moment may be the end of a long period of waiting and praying. You understand what I'm saying? And we want an instant answer. Everything right now. I want to tell you, I haven't found many instant answers to life's dilemmas. They usually come after intense waiting and prayer and listening for the voice of God. And some lessons take years to learn. And then when I think I've actually learned them, I go a few more years and find out that it meant more than what I thought it did. There are just some things you can't learn until you live. And we complain because we don't get the answers. The problem isn't that God doesn't speak. Maybe the problem is there are too many abandoned watches and too many empty towers. And instead of waiting before God, we look for an answer on Christian TV. Probably the worst place to look for an answer. Or we got to buy somebody's book or get a tape. Or we do something else because we don't have the patience. We can't sit and wait for the answer from God. Prayer turned Habakkuk's attention from the problem to the solution. The conquest of confusion begins with a heart that waits and prays. Secondly, he was also a man of faith. He was a man of faith. Here it is. It's Habakkuk 2 and 4. It's repeated three times in the New Testament. Romans 1:17, Galatians 3:11, Hebrews 10:38. The foundation, the cornerstone, the watchword of the Protestant Reformation, the just shall live by faith. He was not only a man of prayer, he was also a man of faith. And the central theme of God's answer to Habakkuk during this period of questioning is right here in Habakkuk 2 and 4. As for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. And the word faith is used in the New Testament in the sense of belief and trust in God's redeeming grace through which we are saved. That is not diminished, that aspect in this verse. But the Hebrew word for faith has another meaning, another idea. And the verse can be translated differently. It can be translated out of Hebrew, the righteous one shall live by his faithfulness. He shall live by faithfulness. Two things here. Let me do this quickly. Here's what he's saying. Let the righteous man, however baffled by his surroundings and by his experience, hold on in loyalty to God and he shall live. Habakkuk is plagued with unanswered questions. There's a crisis of faith. He's struggling with baffling circumstances. And God says, you will live by your faithfulness. You will live by your faithfulness, loyalty to God, moral steadfastness, and integrity. These are the anchors of your life. And in the times of confusion and struggle, a man, a woman must live not because he has all the answers. Not because he understands everything. Not because there are no injustices. Not because everything is working out according to the plan. But he lives on the basis of his moral steadfastness. He lives by his faithfulness. And understand the root of our faithfulness is the faithfulness of God. I can be faithful to him because he is forever faithful to me. And I have not the words to explain or describe to you how incredible is the faithfulness of God. When I was a young Christian and a young preacher, I was enamored with the power of God. And now, having lived as long as I have and experienced the things that I've experienced, what utterly astounds me, it amazes me more than I could ever explain to anyone. I am absolutely astounded and amazed at the faithfulness of God. His mercies, they fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness, O God. You say, why do we have faith? Because he is faithful. Why do we rely on him? Because he's reliable. Why do we trust him? Because he is trustworthy. You'd be a fool to put your faith in somebody who cannot be relied upon, who can't be counted upon. And there's one thing, there's some things I can't understand, I can't figure it out. There have been things in my life I can't explain to this day. I don't know the answer. I can't answer your dilemmas. But one thing I am persuaded, of this. The Lord knows the way that I take. And I am absolutely persuaded that what I have committed unto him against that day, he is able to keep because he's faithful. He's faithful. Hallelujah. Won't you just raise your hands and give God praise in this house? And I'm sick and tired of faith being cheapened by the hucksters and the shysters and the crooks who are stealing money from God's people with all of their schemes and their scams, and they cheapen faith to some little, it is a utilitarian tool of how you can get money and blessing and prosperity and all of that. I'm really, really tired of that. I want to tell you, the test of faith is when everything is falling apart and going wrong, and when the night is long and dark and there's no answer in sight, and when you can feel the hot breath of the devil breathing down your neck, and the lion of hell is roaring against you, and when you can't understand it, and you're entangled in a web of confusion and frustration, that's when the mettle of your faith is tested. And real faith doesn't quit when things are tough and times are bad. It doesn't throw in the towel when prayers seem to be unanswered and tears seem to be unnoticed. That's when real faith stands the tallest and shines the brightest. Faith is not getting what you want from God. It is holding on to God no matter what. Amen. Give clap. You're going to clap. Everybody clap. We're clamping to Jesus. Brother David, it's like a Timex watch. It takes a licking and keeps on ticking. Hallelujah. Where does that come from? Comes from the faithfulness of God. Lord, I can't explain this. I don't understand it. But here's a little verse from a sermon, I think, preached by Spurgeon that was put into a song. When you don't understand, when you can't find His plan, when you can't trace His hand, trust His heart. When you don't understand, when you can't find His plan, when you can't trace His hand, trust His heart. I ask you, do you trust His heart today? Do you trust His heart today? Do you trust His heart? I got to hurry. I'm running out of time here. God gives him some lessons here. He does answer him. Let me briefly just quickly run through these. He tells him, in talking to him, says, basically, here's the lesson. God always has a plan. You may not know what it is yet, but God knows what He's doing. I mean, there's no panic in heaven. He knows what He's doing. God also has an appointed time. He doesn't work on our schedule. He doesn't work for today or for the minute or the moment, but He works for eternity. And that's real important. Here's the next statement. You need to learn this. He who judges God too soon will always judge Him wrongly. And when I say judge, I don't mean that in a legal sense. I mean, if you make a determination too early, if you judge a situation too early and come to a conclusion about God too early, you will always, almost always be wrong. If you judge the cross and Jesus on Friday, you would be wrong. If you had judged Peter when he's out there weeping after denying Lord, if you'd have judged him, you would have been wrong. If you would have judged Joseph in the dungeon down in Egypt, out of Pharaoh's prison, if you'd have judged it then, you would have been wrong. If you'd have judged David when he was in the cave and Saul was hunting for his life, you would have been wrong. Listen, don't mistake the moment for the finale. Don't mistake the moment for the finality. God isn't through yet. You're not finished because He's not finished and He's not done. Don't fret over the wicked. The seeds of destruction, they have that within themselves. They'll be destroyed by their own wickedness. The righteous will be preserved. The just will live by faith. And I love verse 14. God will be glorified in the earth. He said, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And here's the bottom line. True faith doesn't answer all questions. It doesn't remove all doubts. It is just certain about God. It is just certain about God. Here's the final thing. He's also a man of worship. The greatest revelation, not those little lessons, but in the tower, he receives a revelation of God's glory. You want to know how he went from confusion to conquest. He climbed the tower. He watched in prayer. He waited in faith until God revealed his presence to him. Now, I don't have time to read chapter 3, but you should read it. He sees the Lord coming in glory out of Mount Paran. And it's like a song. It is a song. And it's very similar to what Moses experienced when he was descended up on Mount Sinai. His glory covers the heavens. He sees this in chapter 3. Look at it. His praise fills the earth. He rides victorious in chariots with the brilliance of fire and rays of light. The earth shakes. The mountains quake. The sun forgets to rise and the moon goes into hiding as God unleashes his arrows of judgment. And Habakkuk says, well, when I saw it, my lips quivered and decay entered my bones. He shook like a leaf in a March wind. And it's an interesting thing. Same thing happened to Job. Same thing happened to Habakkuk. With the revelation of God and with the appearance of God, Habakkuk's angry protest just stopped. It put an end to the confusion, the questions. Not that they were answered, it's just they didn't matter anymore. Like the lesser lights of the stars are eclipsed in the greater light of the sun. When he rises in the fullness of his glory, everything is eclipsed. Fades away in the light of his glory and grace. And with the revelation of God's glory, the tone of Habakkuk's speech turns. It changes from bitter despair to one of unwavering confidence and hope. He was moved from problems to prayer to faith and to a song. And here it is. It is one of the greatest songs ever written. It is one of the greatest statements of faith that has ever been penned. And here it is in Habakkuk 3:17. Though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vine. Understand, he lives in an agricultural community. His livelihood depends on all of this. The fig tree does not bud. There are no grapes on the vine. Though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. And you wonder, is this the same man? I mean, look at the transformation. Compare him from chapter 1 to where he is now. Need help with that? I thought you might. In chapter 1, he is troubled. In chapter 2, he is taught. In chapter 3, he is triumphant. In chapter 1, he is grappling. In chapter 2, he is grasping. In chapter 3, he is glorying. In chapter 1, he is sighing. In chapter 2, he is seeing. In chapter 3, he is